Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, June 14th, 2014, and I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host today. These are really most dramatic times. If you look at events in the last weeks, you can see two clear patterns developing strategically internationally. On the one side, you see the complete collapse of the empire in terms of the financial system cratering, the move toward bail-in policies in Europe, and it's coming in the United States. And if you don't know what that means, you haven't been paying attention to this program and to the EIR, but it means that the banks are going to start taking your deposits. The banks are not going to get government bailouts. They're going to take your money and tell you they're doing that because they're doing you a service of not having you have to have the government bail them out. But as this is going on, you have a fight over should interest rates go up or down. Draghi is going with a negative interest rate policy in Europe, and that's really having a bad effect on the euro. But, of course, it's building up another bubble. But all these bubbles are going to pop. And at the same time, we see a completely chaotic strategic situation characterized by the imperial policy of destroying the nation state. Now, before we get into that, which will be the subject of our discussion today, I just want to briefly touch on the other side of this so that you have a sense that there are two, as I said, two directions strategically. One is the collapse into chaos and disintegration and likely war, including thermonuclear war. The other side is characterized by the revolt of the populations that we saw, for example, with the May 25th European Union elections. It rejected the pro-Euro and pro-EU parties. We saw it with the Keisha Rogers vote in the United States, where 3 out of 10 Democrats who voted to impeach Obama. We saw it just last Tuesday with the defeat of the number 2 man in the House of Representatives leadership, Republican Eric Cantor, defeated largely as a puppet of Wall Street, as his opponent in the Republican primary identified him. So there is a rebellion against the establishment. The problem is people don't know exactly what they're rebelling against. They don't know what the real enemy is. And on this program today, we're going to have a special look into what is the enemy of this country, the enemy of the United States, and in fact, for that matter, the enemy of humanity. And we're going to look at it from initially the situation that's blowing up in Iraq today, as what seems on the surface that the pledge and the promise that of the Bush administration and the Obama administration that we would go in, get rid of a dictator, bring democracy and freedom, everyone would love America, and then as Obama said, our mission is done, now we're leaving. And what are we seeing? We're seeing the complete disintegration of that nation. Now, some people are saying, well, that's a failed policy. But what we're going to look at is what exactly is the policy, because as our guest will tell you, and he's just written an article on this, it's not a failure of the policy, that was the intent of the policy. So start paying attention, because you're going to get some intelligence today on this program that you'll have to use to educate the people you talk to so they understand who it is we're fighting. So I'd like to welcome to our program Hussein Askari, who is an EIR writer, a candidate, a leader of the LaRouche party in Sweden, a longtime collaborator with Lynn and Helga Zepp LaRouche. And Hussein, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Harley. It's a pleasure to be on this program.
Now, you heard my introduction, and I'd like you to get right into it. You wrote a report that I received a couple days ago. As events were taking place with the collapse of the Iraqi army in Mosul, and what you wrote in that report is that the disintegration of the Iraqi military and the Iraqi government is in fact the intention of the policy which was implemented with the invasion of Iraq after 9/11. So tell us what actually was the policy and how it's been carried out, and let's start with that.
Yes, yeah, because I've seen in the last few days reports and articles saying this was a failure, what's going on in Iraq and the whole Southwest Asia, so-called Middle East and North Africa, is a failure of the Obama administration or a failure of the Western policy, but this is, it was not a failure. Ironically, this was a success, but it was a success for the enemies of humanity. Now, what's going on in Iraq, as others try to report, is like there's a Shia-Sunni conflict. Well, the Shia-Sunnis are maybe in the conflict, but they are not the cause of the conflict. They are the effect of the conflict. The cause of the conflict is something else. It goes long, long time back. But, I mean, for the situation in Iraq, Iraq is my country of birth, and I'm suffering myself from looking at this. But this is just one more peak in the long history of suffering of the Iraqi people. But the Iraqi people are not pessimistic. They always believe they can rise up again. But the thing is not to get gripped by panic. There are people who try to spread panic for their own interests. Everybody is saying this is a terrible surprise situation, but many forces in the region and in the world have their own intentions why they want to spread panic. Yes, this is a horrendous development that this so-called Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant or Syria, the ISIL, and these are bloodthirsty criminals, but they are not the ones who started this. They are tools of a policy. But the fact that they could manage to do something like this is due to the fact that there was a policy to demolish something which is called the sovereign nation state, a principle which was one of the principles in the Charter of the United Nations after World War II.
Hussein, let me just ask you to tell us what exactly is the ISIL, where do they come from, and how did they achieve what appears to be this breakthrough?
Well, the ISIL is another branch of what was started in the Afghan War already in 1979-1980, when the British intelligence, the U.S. intelligence, with the help of Saudis, the Saudi intelligence and others, they went in and implemented what we know as the Bernard Lewis strategy, which means that in order to weaken and defeat the Soviet Union or Russia specifically, is you have to plant an arc of crisis, small conflicts and wars all along the southern tier of the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union. This even goes back to the early days of the British Empire of the 18th and 19th century, which was called the Great Game.
Yeah, the Great Game, exactly.
You have to start fires all around Russia, specifically, but also between Russia and other nations in Europe, like in Germany, which ended up in having two world wars, in order to make sure that the landmass of Eurasia does not get united against the sea-based British Empire. But this was what we know as the Bernard Lewis idea. It's called the Arc of Crises. Some people think this is Zbigniew Brzezinski's idea. It's not. Most of these ideas are adopted by the United States policymakers, but they originate from Britain, from the British Empire. And the imperialist elements in the United States, like Kissinger, Brzezinski, Cheney, Bush, they then adopt that policy. But it's a British policy. So these so-called Islamic jihadist movement started to grow out of the Afghan war, where there was an official policy to support the so-called Mujahideen against the Soviet invaders of Afghanistan. But in order to do that, they had to both finance, train, and arm, and spread an ideology of dehumanizing the other, which is today is called Takfiri ideology, which means that anybody who does not belong to this specific religious theology, which is the Wahhabi Salafi theology, is basically not even human. And they should be killed. They could be killed. Women, children, men, doesn't matter.
You said
and that was spread then out of Afghanistan when the Soviets withdrew. And these movements then moved into the Islamic world, and they were used against the sovereign Islamic and Arab nations, and many of them, like bin Laden, like the Islamic group of Libya, the Islamic group of Algeria, the Muslim Brotherhood, they all moved to Britain, where they started shops from which they would direct, they would fundraise, they would plan and recruit people to attack their own nations.
Now,
so the ISIL, like Al-Qaeda, is a byproduct of that Bernard Lewis plan, the Ark of Crisis plan.
Now, you said in the very beginning that this was a U.S., British, and Saudi operation. And before the program, we were talking about the fact that there were, in spite of British efforts throughout the whole of the 20th century, there were actually nations that functioned to some extent as multi-ethnic, multi-religious nations, Iraq, Syria, you could say Lebanon
exactly.
as well.
This is exactly what the point I want to come to is, what I said, there's all these operations and the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the so-called Arab Spring, the color revolutions in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine now, all these are meant to demolish an idea of what we call a sovereign nation state, a modern sovereign nation state, which means that many ethnic groups and religions can live under the banner of one nation, but that nation has a mission to develop itself and to be of benefit for humanity by developing a culture, a common culture which unites all these religions and peoples and ethnic groups. And that's also a product of the Peace of Westphalia, which came in 1648 after a horrendous 100 years of religious wars in Europe. You know, we are back to that state, but the Peace of Westphalia Treaty established the fact that each nation, no matter what groups and religious groups exist there, their internal matters are their own matters. What nations can do, they can help each other by thinking about the benefit of the other, by developing economic and other kinds of ties, and even cultural ties. And that became the big target.
Right.
And the person who took upon himself from the British Empire establishment to attack that idea was Tony Blair. Tony Blair, since he became Prime Minister of Britain in the middle of the 1990s, this idea existed even before that, but from his sinister position as a leftist so-called Labour Prime Minister, a progressive Labour Prime Minister, he came with a completely new idea, and he started indoctrinating other leaders in Europe and in the United States with a completely new idea. Now, in 2000, we all know now Tony Blair played a key role in organizing the invasion of Iraq and setting up the set of lies which were sold through the Bush-Cheney administration to the world as reason why they should invade Iraq, the question of weapons of mass destruction, Iraq's work with Al-Qaeda, and so on and so forth. But what really is the issue is that already back in 1998-99, Blair was preparing the ideological basis for attacking the Peace of Westphalia. Now, in 2004, Blair wrote a long article in The Guardian in March 2004,
mm-hmm.
And in that article, I just quote so that you just get the clear picture.
Sure.
And I quote from Tony Blair's own article from The Guardian, and he says, "So for me, before September 11th, 2001, I was already reaching for a different philosophy in international relations from a traditional one that has held sway since the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648. Namely, that a country's internal affairs are for it and you don't interfere unless it threatens you or breaches a treaty or triggers an obligation of alliance."
Now, Hussein, I want to point out the importance of that quote because it followed a previous engagement that Blair had in Chicago in 1999 where he was
exactly.
talking
about
this.
Exactly. I'm coming to that, actually.
Yeah. But I think the important thing on this quote is that Americans tend to be myopic or just ignorant when it comes to history and the importance of history. Here you have a leading figure of the British Empire who has been playing a controlling influence on the last two presidents of the United States, who does start from the standpoint of taking up a historic policy and attacking that principle, a principle that brought peace to Europe after it was the 30 Years' War in 1648 that ended, but it was really about 160 years of war. And so I think this is really important for people to understand, because it also connects, as you just did, with the fact that Blair played one of the leading roles in the fraudulent or sexed-up intelligence, which is really just the lies, that provided the basis for the attack on Iraq. So please proceed on this Blair attack on Westphalia, because this is so critical for people to understand.
Yeah, you see, he names the Peace of Westphalia, and he said it held sway. You know, this is not a nice description, since 1648. But then he said, I did not consider Iraq fitted into this philosophy, though I could see the horrible injustice done to its people by Saddam. Now, the poor Tony Blair, he's now bleeding. His heart is bleeding for the children of Iraq. I mean, the sanctions against Iraq killed 500,000 Iraqi children at the time Tony Blair was in power. But in Chicago 1999, he did not name the Peace of Westphalia by name.
Right.
Because that was the intention. But after the invasion of Iraq, 1 year after the invasion of Iraq, he came back and said, my real target was the Peace of Westphalia. But in his speech in Chicago in 1999, he already laid out, it was a massive manifesto, not only about demolishing the idea of the modern sovereign nation state, but even launching financial warfare through what he called globalization to attack nations that are not so-called axes of evil nations, like Western Europe and the United States. So you can strip those nations of their sovereignty. You cannot do it with military force. You cannot invade Germany and say the Germans are developing weapons of mass destruction. But you can incorporate Germany in a failed global financial system or the euro.
Let me just ask you then, how did Iraq function under Saddam? Because there's been so much to make Saddam the boogeyman and the dictator, the killer. Iraq actually did have a common culture that goes back long before Saddam. What was the basis of the Iraqi nation state?
Well, the Iraqi nation state, it went... I mean, the modern Iraqi nation state, it was created really. I mean, the British might say we drew the borders of Iraq in the Sykes-Picot agreement, but that's not completely true. I mean, they drew the exact lines where their sphere of influence and the French sphere of influence would converge. But the reality is that Iraq as a nation did exist. You know, Egypt as a nation did exist for thousands of years, but it went through different stages of development. And, you know, and there are people today who say, well, we should, the borders between Iraq and Syria and Jordan and so on, these were drawn by the British, by the Sykes-Picot, we should change them. No, sorry. We don't play games with these things. I mean, it's like people saying in Africa, the European colonialists drew the borders of these nations. The problem is, if you go on and you try to redivide the countries in Africa or Southwest Asia along tribal or ethnic lines, you will create massive bloodshed. And we saw what happened in Sudan. I mean, we in the LaRouche movement, we were against this so-called referendum in southern Sudan. We knew that South and North Sudan would be split. Susan Rice, the Obama administration, and the British pushed this very part. And look what is going on in southern Sudan. There are two different tribes and guerrilla groups fighting each other. And the situation there is horrible. Southern Sudan might be divided into even smaller groups. And that's the issue. What the British want to do is to create a situation where you have mini tribal states. It's like Qatar, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, even Saudi Arabia. It's a large country, but it's a tribe. It's controlled by one family, which the British control. This is what they want. But Iraq as a nation, you know, it goes back thousands of years of history. And I remember in 2004, even after the invasion of Iraq, Mr. Lyndon LaRouche, he presented what he called the LaRouche Doctrine. And I was in a dialogue with him. And he said the Iraqi people should be given back their constitution, even though it was reshaped under Saddam Hussein. But this constitution goes further down in history as an identity of the Iraqi people, and it should not be changed. So what happened, I mean, Mr. Lyndon LaRouche said, you know, give the Iraqis back their constitution. And although Iraq under Saddam Hussein was some sort of a dictatorship, which most countries in that region today, even the friends of Obama, are dictatorships, that does not eliminate the fact that Iraq is a nation and it has a constitution. Certain changes can be made, but you don't take away a nation. A nation is not a collection of individuals you can take away. So what happened in 2003 with the invasion of Iraq by the British and the United States is that they abolished the Iraqi state completely. So all the military, the Iraqi army was demolished. The Iraqi army was not created by Saddam Hussein. It was created a long time before, but most emphatically since the 1920s, and then developed after that. These were patriotic forces, but under Saddam Hussein's dictatorship, it was part of Saddam Hussein's dictatorship.
Could I ask you something, Hussein, on that? With the army in Iraq as part of the nation, were there Shia and Sunni together in the army under Saddam, or what was the relationship of the groups, the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds? Well,
the Iraqi army was a national army all the time. Well, under Saddam Hussein's time, there were special elite forces, and the top leadership of the army was shifted a little bit to tribes that were loyal to Saddam Hussein, not because they were Sunnis, but because they were loyal to Saddam Hussein. And also because of the fact that with the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini coming to power in Iran, Iran becoming a Shia, so-called Shia force in the region. Remember that the revolution takes place exactly the same time as the Afghan war starts.
Right.
And then the Saudis and the Gulf states, the British-controlled Gulf states, immediately saw in Iran as a sectarian enemy, not another nation, but as a Shia threat. So they supported Saddam Hussein all through the 8 years' war, from 1980 to 1988, to fight Iran, not on the basis of protecting the Iraqi people or the Arab nations, but on a sectarian basis.
And the United States was involved on both sides in that war.
Yes. Yeah, the idea was to continue the war as long as possible to destroy these powerful two nations, which happen to be republics. Mm-hmm. They are not monarchies. They are not tribal sheikhdoms. And therefore, Iran was destroyed first, and then Iraq was destroyed afterward in 1991. So these two powerful nations are now back 30 years, 40 years, 100 years back in history. And then they came the invasion in 2003, but on a completely new basis, that Iraq will be changed into a tribal society. And I remember in 1997 or 98. I remember there was the Chatham House, the Royal Institute for Strategic Studies in London. They organized a conference on Iraq. That was even before the invasion. And the subject was, you know, whether it was good for Iraq to become a federal state. And I called the head of the research section. It's called Rosemary Hollis, a very influential person, because she is like Bernard Lewis. She's a very key person in educating American researchers on relations between Britain, the United States, and the Gulf countries and the Middle East. So I called this lady, Rosemary Hollis, and I said, look, but this could pose a threat because Iraq could be divided and then there will be warring different parties and then the whole region is also divided into all these nations. And she said, well, there's no problem. The United States is a federal state. So the British tried to sell this idea to the United States that Iraq could be divided. That's the best solution into a federal state. So the Kurds, the Arabs, the Sunnis, and Shia, they don't fight each other.
If I remember correctly, as part of the discussion when Bremer came in as the local dictator on behalf of the invasion, the two things he did, one was that they dismantled the army. But wasn't there also discussion at that point of dividing Iraq into three parts? Wasn't that part of the ongoing discussion openly?
Yeah, this became, now the people call it the Joseph Biden doctrine. Because there are some people in the RAND Corporation who presented a study on this. And Joseph Biden supported it as a senator, I guess, at the time.
Yeah, that's right.
And funny enough, in the whole region, it's called the Biden doctrine. But it's the British doctrine.
Uh-huh.
But Biden bought it, like many other American politicians who are not evil people. They're just dummies.
Well, and just to be clear, what would be the effect then?
You demolish the Iraqi state.
Yeah.
With not only the army, the police, the security forces, the government structures, the infrastructure, the archives, everything was destroyed. So 5,000 years of history did not exist anymore. And therefore, you open the door for people. Where do they go for protection? There is no state that will protect them. So people went back to their religious relations or ethnic relations or tribal relations. But then what happened with the majority of the Iraqi army, was the Sunni part of it, were completely humiliated. All their privileges were stripped from them. They became poor. They became targeted in a humiliating way by the U.S. Army, you know, going into their houses, arresting them in front of their kids. And that way they alienated the large part of the Iraqi military leadership and special forces, like in Anbar, in Fallujah, Saladin, and Mosul, which is now has turned into a so-called Sunni Salafi logistics base for this so-called ISIL and Al-Qaeda. But these people were not religious fanatics, but after the invasion of Iraq and all the humiliation they had suffered under the U.S. invasion and the ill-treatment, and then they were discriminated when the so-called Iraqi government was established, and also because they don't have oil resources in that region, so they became a very easy prey to the Saudi and Gulf Wahhabi forces that said, your enemy is Iran and the Shia in Iraq. They are the ones who are behind this, not the British, it's not the U.S. And we can give you money, we can give you... But with the money and the arms came the indoctrination and the same jihadi ideology which was spread in the Afghan war, which is now today is the ISIL and Al-Qaeda Wahhabi ideology, which considers the other as subhuman and the enemy,
which is a complete rejection of Westphalian principles.
Exactly,
looking out for the benefit of the other. Now,
it's a rejection of the identity of the Iraqi nation,
right?
Because the Iraqi nation is many colors and many ethnic groups and religions, but they all coexisted for thousands of years, but most emphatically in the last 100 years as one nation under one flag. And that what created the logistic base for these groups to come in. Mosul, you know, it's 1 million inhabitants, more than 1 million inhabitants. You can't have 1,000 ISIL, Al-Qaeda types coming in and taking over. The fact was that people in that city, the military forces, the security forces, they were fed up with the central government in Iraq, and they decided to welcome those guys. But those guys are out of Mosul now. They went to another place. But what effectively is going on in Iraq now is that instead of a national army, you now have militias, Sunni militias, Shia militias, Kurdish militias, so on and so forth, trying to protect themselves, but on ethnic, sectarian, and tribal basis. And that's what is most dangerous now.
And that just guarantees
the
breakup of the nation.
And I think that's the accomplishment of this, what Blair talked about already then. But now this is also what we're witnessing in Ukraine.
Well,
because
before we get
Ukraine
to Ukraine,
Hussein, as a Ukrainian-Russian nation.
Before we get to Ukraine, because I do want to get to that, because we're dealing with the same principle of the color revolutions, I'd like to just take up Syria again, because there is discussion in the United States where you have complete lunatics like John McCain and Lindsey Graham saying that the reason this is happening in Iraq is because we didn't destroy the Assad regime in Syria, that Obama was a coward and didn't take that on. But in fact, I guess you could say the same thing about Syria, that it also has been a target of the same anti-Westphalian principle.
Exactly. I mean, Syria is more than Iraq. It's a symbol and a model for a nation with many, many ethnic and religious groups that can coexist with one another. I mean, people like John McCain, I mean, they should just retire and, you know.
Well, his brain has.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a tragedy to see those people talking and people listening to them. This is complete nonsense. I mean, the reason you have the situation in Iraq is partially also because of the situation in Syria. The fact that the Obama administration, the British, and the EU supported the same al-Qaeda people we were told that we were fighting against, and they were shipped after having thrown Gaddafi in Libya by British special forces with the backing of the Obama administration and European and NATO aircraft cover. They assassinated Gaddafi in 2011, and they moved al-Qaeda forces from around the world into Libya. And then they used the weapons, which were seized from al-Qaddafi's army, and they were shipped from Benghazi to Turkey and from Turkey into Syria, where this new so-called revolution, Arab Spring Revolution, had started. And, you know, all under the nose of the NATO and even U.S. intelligence forces. I mean, that's why the door was open to assassinate the American ambassador in Benghazi and these other people, because they were told by the British agents, the Qataris and the Saudis, that these guys are green. They got security clearance, said you can work with them, no problem. We have them guaranteed. And then, before you know it, they go and shoot the American ambassador and the same people they're working with. Somebody left the door open and said, you know, you are welcome. Because the Al-Qaeda, they need trophies to show to their supporters that they hate the Americans. They can kill Americans. And this is the biggest prize they can get. And this helps them recruit more people if you kill Americans. Because this has the highest price for it. But this is what happened. You had first into Libya, where you have this so-called revolt against Gaddafi, was militarized by NATO and the United States and the British, and then used the force which was accumulated in Libya and was shipped to Syria through Turkey, a NATO member, where Syria now was laid, you know, completely ruined nation. But fortunately, the Syrian people rallied around their leadership and their army and realized that, you know, the alternative to Assad is hell, this barbaric locust force. It's a dark age force, this Al-Qaeda, ISIL, and these guys. But the leadership of the Syrian opposition, like the former Iraqi opposition who are sitting now in government, they all come from Britain. You know, they were moved to five-star hotels in Istanbul, but they all come from Britain. They have all dual citizenship, British citizenship. Most of the people in the government of Iraq have British citizenship, except for al-Maliki. But everyone else in his government, Shia, Sunni, Kurdish, they have British citizenship because they were in Britain many years. And that's where they were recruited, in the zoo of the British Empire, political zoo, as executive intelligence review.
Yeah,
and that's what created this horrendous situation of lawlessness in last areas of Syria and Iraq. And then with the Saudi, the allies of the British, or the Saudis are part of the British Empire. They're not only allies. They are an organic member, an organic part of the British Empire, but they were supported by the Obama administration. With their support, financial support, logistic support, and Kuwait and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, these locusts, these dark age forces, were able to take over parts of Syria and now Iraq. But it all goes back to the same principle, which I mentioned, that the destruction of the modern nation state as a model for relations among nations in the world and as a model for peace and economic development and cooperation among nations. And that has been the mortal enemy of the British Empire since actually the 18th century. This whole great game against Russia, the British Empire played in Central Asia, in Afghanistan, and then even afterwards, I mean, just to look at this whole so-called Islamic jihadist movement, you have to go back to 1880s when the British first invaded Egypt, and took over Egypt as a nation from the Ottoman Empire. And then they recruited the Al Saud family and the other Gulf states as allies against the Ottoman Empire. And then they used these tribal relations and religious idea. Like in Egypt, the big problem for the British Empire, especially under and after World War I, is that you had a very strong nationalist movement, an Egyptian nationalist movement. But in order to hit that nationalist movement, they had to create a different identity which has no national borders, which is the so-called pan-Islamist identity. And the British...
Let me ask you a specific question on the Egypt situation, because this goes back to the Arab Spring, and it goes back to the somewhat, on the surface anyway, confusing relations of the Saudis with this, because you had with the overthrow of Mubarak and then the election of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power, we were told in any case that this goes against what the Saudis wanted. And I just want you to say a few things about that, because the Egyptian situation is another one of these nation states which was targeted for destruction by this Blair Doctrine.
Exactly. To say that the Saudis, it was not in the interest of the Saudis that the Muslim Brotherhood succeed in Egypt, is the same thing to say that the Bush-Cheney administration and the British tried to bring democracy to Iraq, but unfortunately it didn't work. It's the same thing, because what the Saudis want in Egypt is not that they don't like the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, there are internal differences between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Wahhabis. They don't like each other, but they had an unholy alliance earlier against the nationalist governments of Jamal Abdel Nasser, for example. You know, but the right. Saudis were functioning as tools of the British, because they could use their position in the Islamic world to push things that the British could not push as Christian European imperialists. But through the Saudis, they could attack Egypt through supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. But the idea is not to get the Muslim Brotherhood to succeed, to establish a strong Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood nation. That was not the intention. The intention is to destroy Egypt. And therefore, you have two groups, two countries, who are both British agents, Saudi Arabia and Qatar now, fighting each other in Egypt, where the Qataris support the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Saudis support a so-called military, secular, liberal coup against the Muslim Brotherhood. But you have to look at what is the end result of that conflict, is that Egypt will be destroyed. Yeah. And at the same time, by keeping Egypt economically and socially under the control of Saudi money, which unfortunately the Egyptian leadership made this big mistake. And we in the LaRouche movement, I personally wrote to the Egyptian government, to Egyptian embassies and the media, is a program for making Egypt independent of both the IMF and the Saudi money. Because Egypt, since the time of Mubarak and until today, Egypt can feed its own population by getting charity from the United States, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, and the IMF. But in return, it's destroying its own internal productive powers and its own productivity. In question of, for example, signing free trade agreements with Europe and the United States and other countries. Mm-hmm. So rather than having its own national credit policy, its national strong currency, the Egyptian governments have always been looking to get so-called foreign investment into their economy and developing their infrastructure, developing their agriculture and industry. That was done under Gamal Abdel Nasser until the early 70s, but that was then demolished with the help of Henry Kissinger's liberal policies imposed on Egypt, and then the IMF and the World Bank coming into Egypt. And now the Saudis are the ones who are feeding the Egyptian people by sending money every month, and that way keeping Egypt, one of the most important and powerful Arab nations, begging for money from the Saudis. But that's the policy. If the Saudis don't like the Muslim Brotherhood, well, they have their own reasons. They have theological and other reasons. But the real target is to destroy Egypt as a nation. And that's why Qatar, which is another British agent, is supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Saudis are supporting another gang in Egypt, which is the ones who overthrew. But the intention is not to help this government in Egypt succeed. Because if General al-Sisi will come out tomorrow on TV and say, we are not going to work anymore with the IMF, and we will make sure that we get the internal national credit, which Egypt does have, to launch massive infrastructure, power, agriculture, water, and industrial projects to make Egypt one of the most productive nations, then you will see the reaction from the Saudis and their British backers and even the United States. So the policy is to keep Egypt divided, you know, and poor.
Right, right.
Because Egypt is the backbone of the whole Arab countries and even North Africa.
Hussein, we had in the upcoming issue, the current issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, an article which has an exposure of these colored revolutions, including the Arab Spring, including, as Lyndon LaRouche did, making the point that 9/11 was used to bring about a kind of colored revolution in the United States by having the U.S. Openly commit itself to these ongoing wars, which is destroying the United States. Now, in that package, and I would encourage our listeners to, if you're not already subscribing to the EIR, the kind of analysis you're hearing from Hussein in this discussion today is what we try to feature in the Executive Intelligence Review every single week, so you can get the full story. But in this, we're making the obvious connection, which you made earlier, that the Ukraine situation is an extension of this same policy, and in this case, they're trying to rope Europe and NATO into being the partners in this. Now, I have a specific question for you on this, because there's been, you headed a slate of candidates, I believe, recently in Sweden. There's been an effort to bring Sweden into NATO as a full partner, I believe, with the idea that all of Western Europe now is under threat from Russia. And the expansion of NATO at the point that the European Union is not just failing as an economic union, but is having a revolt against the establishment parties. Give us a picture from what you see of the nature of this revolt, and then from there we can probably the last 15 minutes take up this question of how do we get out of this situation? But yes, tell us first what happened with this vote back in May 25th.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, first of all, the participation in the European Parliament elections was, you know, like less than 50% of the people were interested in it. So the vote was below 50%. And then the majority of the votes went to parties and movements and groups that were against the EU. So the parties who were for the European Union got only about 20 to 25% of the vote. So the support for the European Union is being lost right now completely, because under the pressure of these bailout and now bail-in policies of the European Union, the people in Europe who are living under the European Union, they see that they are not only being stripped of their sovereignty, of their right to decide their own policies, but they are becoming poorer, they are becoming unemployed, and now finally becoming involved in wars. But in spite of the fact that there is all this propaganda against Russia in the media here, the fact is, like in Sweden, we have, because of historical facts, Sweden was attacked by the Russians, and we had wars with Russia many times. So this fear of the Russians is very enormous in Sweden. But in spite of that, the support for joining NATO is minimum in this country. I mean, the Prime Minister dared to say it just once on TV that he's for joining NATO, but, you know, nobody believes that, because the Swedish people will never accept getting into NATO, no matter how much propaganda they have against Putin. But the reality is that Europe is being bankrupted by the same policy which I mentioned, the same policy which Tony Blair spread here in Europe, the so-called third way, which he pronounced in this Chicago speech, where the nations of Europe will be incorporated into a globalized financial and economic system, where the priority will become not the old left industrial and infrastructural development, but will be in the financial market. And that thing is have destroyed Europe. And now, therefore, now Europe is the propaganda, the war propaganda is being used to gather together whatever force is left in Europe, both for the bail-in policy and to launch war against Russia. But people are getting more and more scared of this, and they're rejecting more and more the whole policy, and therefore people voted for parties that are completely against the EU, like the Jean-Marie Le Pen in France, and the UK party in Britain, and even here in Sweden for the first time these anti-immigrant parties coming to the European Union. But most people vote for these because they're against the EU and mm-hmm. against the EU policy, both on right and left. So the EU is, as we said in our campaign, we should put it in a museum. It's a dangerous thing. We should go back to the idea of sovereign nations, but we can cooperate together. But what instead of the EU, we should have Eurasia, or Euroasia, where we can start collaborating with the nations who are becoming the engine of the world economy in the East, like China and its members. So the idea of the EU and NATO is people are realizing this is becoming an existential threat to their life and their livelihood.
Our colleague Jacques Cheminard on this program 2 weeks ago said that one of the problems that existed with the vote is that it was a negative vote, but there was no vision. But you've been working to pull together a program as part of the work you've been doing with the LaRouche movement in Europe that would connect the Eurasian perspective with the Middle East. And I'd like you to discuss that a little bit, because in this country we're going very aggressively with LaRouche's four-point program, which is a program to break the power of the British Empire and establish an American system credit policy so the United States could participate with the Eurasian countries. And clearly this is in the interest of the countries we've been discussing, as opposed to permanent warfare and breakup. So give us a picture of what this Eurasian development perspective means for the countries of the Middle East.
Exactly. I think in the time when Mr. Lyndon LaRouche said, when he presented his LaRouche Doctrine for Southwest Asia in 2004, and even before that, but the last time, we've been working intensively to get an idea for a question of peace through economic development in Southwest Asia, but even with Helga Tsepp LaRouche's work until recently, to present a peace proposal, an economic development proposal for the nations of Southeast Asia, and North Africa, I'm afraid that the time has passed to get anything done from that region. We are now in a situation where there is an existential threat to the whole world, to the whole planet. And I think things can only be addressed from the top-down perspective, which Mr. Lyndon LaRouche has laid out the last few days, what he called the four laws. And I think, because I have heard President Obama saying we might intervene militarily and so on, but let me address the American people and American intellectuals and others who may be misled by all this, the media thing. I mean, there is nothing the United States can do militarily to improve anything in the world. Just stay at home. You can do nothing. But you can be of a great service to all humanity by doing several things in your own country, things which Mr. LaRouche has presented. And first of all, to stop the whole British policy and genocidal policy, which I discussed in the beginning. Mm-hmm. What you can do as American patriots is to outflank the British. And you can do that by neutralizing their most important asset, the resident of the White House, through legal means, by impeachment. If you impeach President Obama, and you bring about a realization that a new leadership in the United States should cut all so-called special relationships with the British Empire or any other imperial idea. That would be one of the greatest services to humanity. But then you should, the world needs the United States in a different way, and this is the way which the world needed Franklin Roosevelt. And even with the vision of President Kennedy, which was not realized, is that the United States, not only through implementation of the Glass-Steagall Act, to control the whole financial and banking situation, and that way making sure that the United States can stand on its own feet again with the National Credit Program to rebuild its own economy with massive infrastructure and economic development programs for its own people. And then through that idea, by realizing that idea for the United States as a nation, as a sovereign independent republic, because that has been the target, as you mentioned earlier. Mr. LaRouche said there was a coup against the United States. There was a color revolution in 2001, in 9/11. It was a red revolution. It was a military coup, which the Anglo-Saudis launched. If the United States can free itself and become not an imperial force, you know, tugged behind the British Empire and become a sovereign republic and show the world what you can do with a national economic development policy and national credit policy, then that could be a way, you know, that would be a beacon of hope for the whole world. And you can use that policy to start negotiations with other nations, most emphatically. And also to realize Franklin Roosevelt's vision is that the United States and Russia should start cooperating, but also the United States and China and India, what we used to call the four powers. If they get together to establish a completely new world economic and political order and sidestep the British Empire and even the EU, because unfortunately we don't have sovereign nations in Europe anymore. But you can, that through that act, you can also free forces in France and Germany, specifically, and Italy, where they can become, you know, sovereign, independent nations again. But through the using the power and the history of the United States and the identity of the United States as a free, sovereign nation state, a republic, you can create shockwaves all around the world. And I think that's the way the Southwest Asia and Iraq will be freed, because from looking at the world from inside Iraq, things are going to hell. But if you look at things from outer space, so to speak, as a real leader in the world, and every citizen in the U.S. or anywhere in the world should act and think like a real leader, then you can get a totally different vision. There is enormous suffering in Iraq. There is suffering in Ukraine, in Africa, in many parts of the world. But that will not be resolved from intervening in the local situation. But you can change it by intervening on the policy of empire, which created this whole tragedy, not only for Iraq, but for the whole world, including the United States itself. And I think that's the real message today, that people are expecting to come from the United States itself. And your work, and especially what Keisha did in Texas, this is really appreciated everywhere.
Well, and that there's no military option. I mean, we've been involved in wars now for over a decade directly in Iraq, in Syria, and the situation has only gotten worse. So the idea that McCain and others are saying that Obama should use military force, drones, bombing, that's certainly no solution. Now we have a little bit of time left, and you know, again, I'd like to. I think it's important for Americans to hear from people who have this broader strategic perspective, and yourself as an Iraqi, but someone who's lived and worked in Europe for many years. The importance of a conference coming up this Sunday in New York City. Tomorrow, the Schiller Institute is sponsoring a 30-year anniversary conference. There'll be one in Europe later in the autumn. But the theme is an end to war. And from this standpoint of development versus the obvious effects of war. You know, I'd like your thoughts on that as a theme for real strategic discussion in politics.
Yes, I think the subject which, I mean, the reason I joined the LaRouche movement and the Schiller Institute when I came to Europe in 1993, after having seen the horrendous Gulf War in Iraq in 91, I mean, what is most fascinating is that there is a solution to things. And the solution to things is peace through economic development, but not economic development in terms of material development. Because what the LaRouche movement has presented as an economic program, what LaRouche calls physical economy, is a cultural renaissance. But you have to build the physical economy to free the human beings, as Prometheus did, from the chains of servitude to the physical needs of every day, and to make human beings able to look at the stars rather than looking at their feet all day round. And I think this is the most important message that people have to understand in the world, that there is a solution, there is a way to peace. But in order to be able to see that, you have to rid yourself of this oligarchical imperial idea, you know, which dehumanizes human beings, either in the sense of religious enemies, or the green ideology looks at human beings as dangerous parasites. And therefore, the whole concept of what the LaRouche movement represents and the Schiller Institute represent is the key to the whole situation. And I think that's what people have to both think about and also to support. And I think this is what one of the reasons I decided to join this movement, being an Iraqi coming as a refugee from war, but then realizing that I have a responsibility to both my nation and to the world to understand these ideas and try to proliferate them, but also to recruit and organize other people to join this movement to be able to achieve that. And I think this is not simply about a movement, this is about all nations and the whole world.
Well, Hussein, we'll make sure you get reports from the proceedings in New York City on Sunday. And, of course, actually, we have just a little bit of time left. I'd just like to get one final thing from you, which is that I know in the United States, the organizing reports we're getting is that Americans are very concerned, upset, questioning what's actually going on in Iraq. Why? And I think this is a tremendous opportunity to organize people to understand what you've been discussing today about this oligarchical plan to destroy the nation state. Is there a similar kind of response in Europe? Are people looking at this with horror and basically asking themselves, how did this happen? What do we do?
Yes, sure. I mean, they're, especially among young people, there's a complete distrust of the mass media and the politicians. That's why people are not interested in politics, which is also a dangerous thing. People are abandoning politics because they don't believe in anybody. They don't believe in the stories they're being told about anywhere in the world, because they were also lied to about the financial and economic situation in their countries. So people don't trust anybody. But the thing is that you always face, and I think this is what people have to be really, really aware of, is that you cannot understand the world from looking at what things happening every day. You know, it's like a sequence of pictures happening right in front of you. To be able to understand things happening today, you have to understand history. You have to look at the long arc of history and what ideas have shaped that history, because you'll be completely confused. We are in a wartime. All news are lies. I don't believe anybody. My father told me during the Iran-Iraq war, I was like 13, 14 years, I said, "Why don't you read newspapers, father?" He said, in the wartime, all newspapers lie, all the television lie. Don't believe anybody, because everybody is using that, and facts are being changed and turned into different, to the opposite. But if you understand history, then nobody can lie to you. And I think this is the big challenge that people, that's why our material for people here is a bit more difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. Than others, but it's more crucial for their survival.
Yeah.
Is that you have to understand history. You have to understand the history of ideas. And otherwise, you'll be completely confused and sold.
At that point, we're going to have to wrap it up, because this is the we're all out of time, but I really thank you for joining us today and for giving your assessment of the situation. Again, people can go to the EIR where we'll have extensive coverage on the situation in, with the colored revolutions in this issue, and I'm sure you'll be writing something for the next issue. So, Hussein, thank you very much for joining us, and we will be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of the LaRouche Show.
Thank you very much.